So this is something that affects us all. It's called worry, and we did a talk on worry about some time ago, probably a year ago, but it's a vast topic and something that everyone deals with on a regular basis. So this will be the introductory part of a 2 or 3 part series, and there's not a lot of scripture in this part. It's just kind of setting it up for next week when we tell the stories of great saints and sages who have conquered this problem of worry. Everything's based on the teachings of His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. Now, in any given crowd, there's probably a lot of people, or a percentage of people, for whom worry is just not a problem. And if you're one of those people, you can just find a couch somewhere, go to sleep, and we'll wake you up when it's all over. In fact, you worry so little that your wife sometimes gets your blood pressure taken just to make sure that it's there, you know. So there's people like that there who are already chilled out. You never have to tell them to chill out. In fact, people are worried about them that they don't worry enough. You see what I'm saying? So if you're one of those people, you know, you can just go to sleep or just go home right now because this isn't your concern. Here's one of those people there. The wife has just taken a pair of cymbals and slammed them by surprise behind his head. And the doctor has got the blood pressure cuff on. And after having shocked him, and his teeth are rattling, his eyes are bugging out of his head, the doctor says, "I believe we got your blood pressure back up to normal." That's one way to do it. And then there are people that are over-worried. They internalize everybody's problems. Just like Atlas here, you see, Atlas weighed down by the burden of the world. There are people that just, you don't have to worry. In fact, they do enough worrying for you. They've got you covered. You know, the rest of us don't have to worry because they're in overdrive worry. And so they're over-worriers, and they're the other extreme from the under-worriers. We get these pat phrases like, "Don't worry, be happy." But how do you actually don't worry? I mean, how do you stop yourself from worrying? Is that possible? It's like trying to make yourself go to sleep. The harder you make yourself go to sleep, the less likely you are to go to sleep. So you can't, it's not an exercise of willpower. You can't just stop yourself from worrying. The middle ground is there are a lot of people that normally don't worry too much. I mean, they don't worry disproportionately. But, you know, with the stock market drop and the mortgage foreclosures and the higher rate of unemployment and just all kinds of signs all over the world, growing threat of terrorism and all like that, people that normally wouldn't worry that much have actually started to worry. And the bookstores are full of books on this topic. And the reason that this topic sells so much is that people worry. They worry now, and they've always worried, and they always continue to worry. And the reason that there's a lot of books is because no one book has ever solved the problem. If there was one book that you read it, and then you stop worrying, then there wouldn't be any need for any of the other books. But there's so many books because none of the books have actually succeeded in stopping you worrying. And in the face of worry, 3 questions should be posed. And an interesting thing is even if you say yes, even if you acknowledge that your answer to each one of these 3 questions is yes, you're still going to go ahead and worry. You're still going to go ahead and worry, no matter what. And the first question is, have you, by worrying about anything, prolonged your life? Has worrying ever added time to your life? See what I'm saying? Or, so we get a yes answer, say, who by worrying can add an hour to your life? And the answer is, yes, it doesn't work. No, it doesn't add any time to my life. Then the corollary to that is, by worrying, am I not only taking time off of my life, but am I not also putting stress and hypertension into those that are around me, my children, my family, my parents, and so on? Maybe I'm not only shortening my own life by worry, but I'm also shortening the lives of those I love. So that's 2. Who have worried so much, taken off their life expectancy and that of their spouse? And the 3rd is, what you worry about, is it more important than life? Is it more important than life, or does it enhance life? In other words, would you trade your life for anything that you're worrying about? And the answer is no. Having life is the greatest gift in the world. And when we worry, we jeopardize it. And nothing we worry about is equal in value to life itself. So those are the 3 questions. Have you extended your life by worry? And the answer is no. Or have you shortened your life by worry? The answer is yes. Have you shortened the life of those who are near and dear to you by worry? And the answer is probably yes as well, you see. And have you placed less valuable things over and above the greatest thing of life? And that's probably yes. And in spite of the fact that all those answers are yes, we still go on worrying. Here's a guy lying on the psychiatrist's couch, and the motto above on the wall above him is, worry now, pay later. Well, as I said, there's no one book that solves the problem, otherwise the other books would go away. The literature has not solved the worry problem, it's still there, and in fact, 5,000 years ago it was a problem also. Krishna specifically addresses it in the last chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. He says, Sarva dharma parijaga ma me kam saranam bhaja aham tam sarva papabhyo mokshasi ma suchaha. Give up all varieties of duties and just surrender unto me. In return, I will protect you from all sinful actions. Please do not worry. Do not worry. So why is Krishna saying do not worry? Because obviously there was a lot of worry around there. And the worry was caused by having sought out other measures which are not as powerful or not as comprehensive as Krishna to take care of our problems. Abandoning all varieties of religion, just surrender unto me and I will protect you from all sinful reactions. Do not worry. So here's an indication that if we place our devotion properly, if we devote ourselves in the proper way, if we identify what's the most important thing to be devoted to, and if it's the rock, the all-powerful Lord, then that properly placed devotion will banish to the sidelines all the other things about which we're so worried. The mystery of worry, the secret of worry, is that we worry about what we're most devoted to. We worry about what we're most devoted to. Whatever's in the core of your heart, you worry about that. Whether it's your retirement funds, or whether your kids, whether your health. If you're single, you're worried about, am I going to get married? If you're married, you're worried about, is my marriage going to last? Or is my marriage going to break up? Or you're worried about your finances? Or you're worried about your parents' approval? You're worried about intangible things like terrorists and things like that? So whatever is at the core of your heart, that's what you worry about. I never worry about anybody else's children's grades. I don't worry about Adrian's grades in school. I don't worry about it. I mean, I hope you do well. If you want, if you're having trouble, you come, we'll pray for you. But, you know, I don't lose any sleep over your grades. I mean, I probably shouldn't admit that, but, you know, I don't really worry about that because I'm not devoted to your grades. You know, I'm not devoted to your grades. I'm not devoted to your grades, you know. You know, I don't worry that much about Jai Krishna's kids. I mean, I'm concerned. We just talked about Zach and he's in harm's way and all this kinds of stuff and like that. But, you know, I didn't raise the kids and I'm not devoted to them. You see what I'm saying? I'm very concerned about them. I've known them all their life and so on and so forth. But again, it's not something I lose sleep over. He probably does because he's devoted to his kids. Like that. I don't worry about someone else's retirement fund. I don't worry about whether they're going to have a nice fat nest egg when they retire or whether they're going to be, you know, scrimping and saving when they retire because I'm not devoted to any of those things. I'm not devoted. So your worry follows your devotion. Whatever it is that you're devoted to, your worry follows that. So we don't worry about other people's jobs, other people's wives, other people's kids because we're not devoted to that. Here's another cartoon. I can't worry about that now because I'm worrying about something else. As I said, worry reflects your core devotions. And here's a lady, she's died, she's gone to heaven. Tell me what difference this makes, but still, she's so core devoted to the business of the kitchen and the housewife that her first question upon entering the pearly gates is, since you have a complete record of my life, could you tell me if I remembered to turn the stove off? Well, hello, that's not an issue anymore, lady. Number one worry in all the surveys among Americans, especially recently, is finances. They're worried that they're going to run out of money before they run out of life. They're going to run out of money before they run out of life. And that causes them to amass more and more and more, as if they were going to live for 500 years. And so they spend their money, their time, accumulating money to try to feel comfortable and secure about their future. 70% of people say they worry about their finances. We'd all like to do good works. We'd all like to give in charity. We'd like to give our time to help out the community in various ways, volunteer at the hospital, do the food bank, and so on and so forth. But we can't do that and fulfill our core devotion at the same time. We can't do that and fulfill our core devotion at the same time. So unfortunately, because we haven't got our devotion, the object of our devotion, we haven't got the proper object of devotion, there's lots of good things we'd like to do, but somehow or other we never get around to doing them. I give this example so many times, and I probably shouldn't belabor it so much, but I went to North Carolina about a year ago. There's a devotee community there, and there are many devotees my age that came up to me, and they shared that, you know, a whole season of our life went by, and we don't know what happened to it. You know, we just thought we'd devote ourselves briefly to a health insurance program, briefly to a nice residence, briefly to some measure of material security. And one thing led to another, and it was entangling, entangling, and one year led to another. And now we're 60 years old, and we really didn't do what we had hoped to do with our lives. And we didn't get rid of worry either, because it was worry that misled us, that took us down the garden path. So you can't have it both ways, whether you talk about the Bhagavad Gita, whether you talk about the Bible, the Quran. Over and over and over again, it says you have to choose. You have to choose between your stuff, and you have to choose between God. You can't have it both ways. In the Bhagavad Gita, it says that what is night for one is day for the other. For the materialistic person, stuff is day. And for the spiritualist, stuff is night. For the materialistic person, spiritual life is night, and for the spiritualist, stuff is night. If I got that right, but I'm sure you know what I mean. You can't be devoted to the one and despise the other. Of course, we'd like to do that. We'd like to have our stuff, and we'd like to be devoted to God. But there's a tension there. There's a tension there that will never go away until you consider shifting your devotion totally to the Lord. Because your stuff is temporary. And your stuff, you'll always worry about it. And why we'll always worry about it? Because there's a good reason to worry about it. If you're really devoted to your stuff, then you should be worried. Because the stuff is temporary. And what is the major stuff that we're worried about, that we're devoted to? It's this body. You know, how much effort and concern and worry and anxiety do we put into maintaining this body? And if that's where our core devotion is, we talked about gym rats the other day. Gym rats, you see. If that's your core devotion, if your core devotion is in the gym, you should be worried. Because this beautiful body, you know, as ripped and as flush and as powerful and as bulging as it is just going to be ashes or dust or even stool someday when the scavengers eat it and pass it out. So you should be worried. You should be worried. Because you're putting your faith, you're taking shelter of something which is temporary. 300 years before Christ, Chanaka Pandit, a very wise man, he said, jnana on the one hand, transcendental knowledge, and sense gratification on the other hand. Knowledge, sense gratification. Knowledge, sense. Well, why can't I have sense gratification and also accumulate knowledge too? He said, it just doesn't work that way. They're just mutually exclusive. He says, if you want sense gratification, if you want to live a life of indulging the senses, a life of hedonism, he says, then you just give up any pretense at knowledge because you'll never get it. Only when the senses are controlled do you get to see everyone equally. In the Bhagavad Gita, it says, a pandit is someone samadarshana, sees everyone equally because he's not trying to exploit or manipulate people or entities for his sense gratification. How many meat eaters see animals as without a soul? That's very convenient for them because they're exploiting the animals. So they don't see that within the body of an animal is also a soul, same as within our bodies. In fact, the word animal means soul. So when you say animal has no soul, you've just contradicted yourself. But it's easier to eat the animal if you say it has no soul. But that means that you have no knowledge. Someone once told Prabhupada, they said, well, the difference between us and animals, and the reason that we can eat animals is because they don't understand metaphysics. And we do. And Prabhupada just started laughing. And he said, well, what's he laughing about? He says, physics means physical things, like this body. And metta means above. So if you understand what's above the body, what motivates the body, then you would understand that every living, moving, animated thing is so by a soul. So if you actually understood metaphysics, then you wouldn't kill the animals and you'd regard them equally. And only a person who's free from sense gratification is unbiased and unsectarian, because they regard the elephant, the dog eater, and the Brahman equally. Not on the outer dress do they judge them, but on the inner self or the inner person. So you can't have knowledge and have sense gratification, because if your life is dedicated to sense gratification, you're always calculated. Oh, these are my friends because they're going to promote my sense gratification. These are my enemies because they're going to stand in the way of my sense gratification. How many teenagers, you know, as soon as the first hormones, you know, my father even said this of me, you know, when I was about 12 or 13, he used to be so cute. Very, very pointedly one time, Prabhupada said, I mean, my father said to a third, the kids used to be so nice, you know. I mean, there's a period when, you know, we just depend on the Father, we trust the Father, and we love the Father, and Father is everything to us. But then, isn't it, when we get in our teens and those hormones sort of kicking in, and we notice girls and stuff like that, and this rising tide of sense gratification just overwhelms us, then we start seeing our parents as enemies. We loved them. When we saw them, we would run into their arms and jump in them and hug them. I remember my whole day was made when Dad would come home from work. You know, I'd just wait and count down like that. But when I got in my teens, he became an enemy. You know, if he wouldn't let me use the car, if I couldn't get my driver's license at 16, or this or that and the other thing. And then there's all that combativeness. They're the same parents. They love you just as much. But now you're fixed. You're roaring for sense gratification. And then later on, when you're 30 or 40, and the hormones are starting to abate a little bit, oftentimes we reconcile with our parents, if we're lucky and they're still alive then. But this is how things get divided, get acrimonious, and get sectarian. It's on the basis of sense gratification. So you can't cultivate knowledge, real knowledge, at the same time cultivate sense gratification. Of course, the scientists, so-called scientists, they know a lot of things. They know a lot of things to promote sense gratification. But that's not high-class knowledge. That's not high-class knowledge. That's low-class knowledge. Knowledge to promote sense gratification. And the result of this low-class technical type of knowledge is that the whole world is divided. I read recently that at any given time, there are 40 wars going on. 40 wars going on at any point in the globe. And the weaponry is ever increasingly more dangerous. So that kind of knowledge doesn't bring peace. It doesn't bring satisfaction. It doesn't bring people together. It actually depends upon dividing. Like they say, divide and conquer. Divide and conquer. They go together. Unification is the antithesis of conquering. Unification means living together amicably. So we love our stuff and we love Krishna, and over here's our stuff and over here's Krishna, and I love my stuff and I love Krishna. I really don't want to make that decision. I'd really rather put off making that decision. I'd really not rather not be put into a corner. But imagine if you shifted your devotion, what would happen to your worry? And here you see a devotee with japa beads in his hand. And he's taking the best time of his day, which is the early morning hours, and based on what you do in the morning, it's a good predication, it's a good indicator of how the rest of your day is going to go. So what he's doing, right after he gets up and showers, he's got his japa beads in his hand, and he's dedicating time towards reawakening, reminding himself of God, and placing God, not finances, not approval, not gender relationships, not retirement concerns, not the kids. These are all valid reasons for concern, but when you chant and take the best time of the day to chant the name of the Lord, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare, you're shifting your devotion from temporary things to that which is eternal. And instead of sheltering underneath things themselves, which will be vanished in the oblivion of time, you're sheltering at the lotus feet of God. And that's why that image comes up so often in our literature. Shelter at the lotus feet. Shelter at the lotus feet. Lotus feet. Krishna came here 5,000 years ago from the spiritual world. He didn't come here like we come here. He came to the world, but he was not of the world. And that's why he's described as lotus this and lotus that and lotus the other thing. He's not touched by the problems and worries and upheavals of this world. And so if you grab hold of those lotus feet and place them in your heart, actually Krishna is already in your heart. Your heart is like a lotus, and he's already in your heart. And if you chant and purify the heart, take the dust, so to speak, off the mirror so that it reflects a pure vision, you'll see that Krishna, God, is in your heart. And just as he doesn't worry about the temporal things of this material world, those who have taken shelter, they don't worry either. We are eternal. That means we existed before this universe and will continue to exist after. So there's nothing you're doing in the universe which is actually worth worrying about. I mean, you do it to the best of your ability, but you just don't worry about it because there's no percentage in it. There's no advantage in it whatsoever. So what would happen to your worry if you shifted your devotion? And scripture tells us not to worry about our life. You know, not to worry about our... In the old days, maybe thousands of years ago, people had to worry about clothes, they had to worry about food, they had to worry about shelter, they had to worry about so many things to have to do with day-by-day existence. Nowadays, we don't worry so much about those elemental things, but we might be worrying about a retirement fund, how our kids are doing in school, whether they're going to get into the school of their choice. We might be worried about, I'm single, I'm 20. Steve Young, the quarterback for BYU, said he got to be 36 years old without being married. And according to, I think his great-great-grandfather Brigham Young, anyone who's not married after the age of 25 is a menace to society, see? So, but you shouldn't worry about that. You know, you shouldn't worry about that. Whether you're single, worry about your health, whether you're going to get a job you don't like. You don't worry about these things. Not to say these things aren't important, but you're just not meant to worry about them. And you don't not worry about them because you know what the outcome is going to be. You don't not worry about them because you know you're going to get married to the right girl. You don't not worry about them because you know your retirement fund will be all right. You don't not worry about them because you know the approval of your parents and your employees will be there. No, that's not guaranteed. None of that's guaranteed. There's no guarantee that your child will get into the school of his choice. There's no guarantee that you'll get a job that you like. There's no guarantee that your investments will hold water and that you'll have a good retirement fund. But still, don't worry about it. Just don't worry about it, you know. It's not that we're not worrying about it because we know what the outcome is. We don't know what the outcome is. Things are uncertain. And we don't actually know what the outcome is going to be. But we still should not worry about it. We don't have to worry about it. There's a way to face uncertainty tomorrow and simply not have to worry about it today. And again, we ask the question, is life not more important than food and more important than clothes? When we were given the gift of life, we're given $1 million, why would we worry about $5 and $10 concerns? If you're given $1 million, don't your $5 and $10 concerns go away? But we're just like that. We have the gift of life, and we're worrying about these temporary things, and they're like $5 or $10, and the result is we shorten our lives, and we shorten the lives of those who are around us. It doesn't make sense at all. So we need to pull back from our hyper-focus on things like retirement, health, kids, school, marriage. We need to pull back from worrying about them. And look around us. Look at the birds. Look at the birds. They don't worry. We've had Jai for 17 years now, our African great. I never saw him worry. He's always ready to dance, you know. He's just like, you just start dancing. Where's Jai anyway? He's always ready to dance. He's always happy like that. Pedro, you know, Pedro the macaw, he's always flipping himself upside down and doing antics and acrobatics and all that. They're not concerned. They're not concerned about where their maintenance is going to come from. Now, they don't have anything in the bank. They haven't stored stuff up in barns. They don't have pantry. They don't have a survival kit. But they're not worried about it. They're not worried about it because they know their Heavenly Father will provide them with food. Every morning of every day, 8,400,000 species wake up, and within an hour they've had breakfast. Of course, some of them have breakfast on each other, but that's another story altogether. The point is, that they don't worry about it, you know. So just when you're worried and when you're getting tense, just take a moment out and come and visit with Jai, or visit with Pedro, or visit with Peaches, or just look at this place has millions of birds. This place, this is like a bird sanctuary, you know. In fact, if we put out the food for the birds in the cage, and we take the bird, then by morning it's all gone, because all the other birds come in and eat all the bird food. And if you ever looked at the guide wires, the antenna tower, some days it's like Alfred Hitchcock, you know, the birds. There's like millions of birds, and I say, I hope they don't attack, because we wouldn't have a chance. You know what I'm saying? Like that. So just take a time out and look at the birds. And you say, look at the birds, my husband's not coming back. Look at the birds, I don't have a car, I need a job. Look at the birds, my son is failing the 11th grade, and you want me to look at the birds? I don't feel very well, and you want me to look at the birds? Are you kidding me? Well, if you're finished now, here's what Prabhupada says in a book called, in a Back to Godhead article called Nature's Control. Perfect civilization depends on the arrangements made by God, even as the lower animals depend upon them. Birds chirp in the morning and do not worry about how they are going to find food during the day, for they know that there is food provided and that they simply have to go get it. Our real problem is not insufficient food or sleeping arrangements. Our real problem is that we have forgotten God. And in a lecture in 1971 in London, Prabhupada said, Don't worry. Just like the swans and the ducks in St. James, they don't worry what to eat. I think this is in London, isn't it? St. James Park. Prabhupada used to go for his morning walks in the park in London. They don't worry what to eat. They're getting their eatables. They don't go to the office, to the factory. Even the swans and ducks, and what to speak of human being. This is nature's study, that the swans and ducks, they're getting a home, they're getting their sex life, they're getting their food. Immediately, everything is there. According to their standard, everything is there. Even a small duck, he's got everything ready there in St. James Park. So if a duck is provided with all the necessities of life, why shall I not be? I am so much developed human being. We are created in the image of God. We are created. So if a duck and a bird is going to get their provisions, why are we not going to get their provisions? Prabhupada used to say, the elephant gets his 500 kgs of food a day, and the ant gets his little bit. So they're not theistic, they don't know about the soul, they don't know about God, and yet they get their ration every day. They're atheists, there are people who write books decrying God, denouncing God, there is no God. And they're also being provided for. So why will not human beings be provided for? And amongst human beings, why will those who are not doing their level best to serve the Lord not being provided for? I was telling someone earlier while I was doing a tour that my mother used to tell me, when she was alive, she would say, when I send you money on your birthday, make sure you don't give it to Krishna. And it wasn't that she didn't like Krishna, but she's a mother, so she wanted me to make sure my teeth were okay, make my medical bills, get clothes and all like that. But of course, Krishna has always provided those things for me. He's always provided those things for me. I've never worried in the service of Krishna the last 40 years. In fact, we're living in the best house on the block. It's Krishna's house, not my house, but it's the best house on the block. And we're living here, not as the masters, but as the servants. If you're willing to be the servant of the Lord, then there's no limit to the opulences that are available. But the funny thing was about my mother, she said, spend it on yourself, whatever you need, dental and make like that. As if Krishna wasn't already providing for me. But the thing is, and what we were doing, we were going down the stairs and someone was asking, why are the donations always like 101, 151, 501, why are they not even numbers? And I said, in India, you always put the one because it represents God. It just reminds you that you're giving to God. So the funny thing is, my mother, even though she told me, you know, spend it on yourself, don't spend it on Krishna, every time my birthday would come around and I would get a check, it would be 101, you see, or 301, or 501. So on some level, number one, she really wanted me to spend it for Krishna. And on another level, being a religious person herself, I think she had an understanding that after all, I was being taken care of. I was being taken care of in a grand fashion. So without even trying, you know, the birds who have no sense of God consciousness, at least can't verbalize it, they're getting along fine. They just they see some string and they feel a compulsion to pick up the string and build a little tree for it. And then they ask the question, well, didn't I just do this last year? They have no budget, no mortgage, no Quicken. They just go with the flow. They just go with instinct. You know, we're out there working hard, doing our level best, taxing our brain, running here and there with cars and resumes and computer printouts and all like that. And they're just like, oh, here's some string. Let's go build a fort. Didn't we do this last year? I'm not sure. And then at a certain time of year, when there's a little chill in the air, hey, let's fly south. Well, that sounds like a good idea. Didn't we do that last year too? I'm not sure, but let's do it, you know. You know, they're practical. They don't sow or reap or store in barns. They don't have 401ks. They don't have a college education. They don't make their kids wear helmets. The birds just take their little babies when they feel they're ready, the edge of the nest, and they just push them out, you know. Good luck! they build their nest as high as they can, and then they just push them out. So there's a parenting model for you. Now, we're not suggesting that you not act to your full capacity. We're not just saying when you're faced with a dilemma, just go get your surfboard and have a latte. That's not the message at all. But if you place your devotion on the Lord, if the Lord is in the core of your heart, then you will not have to worry about things. You'll do the best you can do today and let tomorrow take care of itself. You won't worry today about tomorrow, and you won't worry today, you'll work today. You'll work today. How many of you had something to do and then you're just worrying about, I should do that, I should do that, I should do that, and in the amount of time you spent worrying about, you could have done it 6 times. So don't worry today, work today, and let tomorrow take care of itself. Do all that you can today and then leave tomorrow in the hands of God. This is expressed, nitya nityanam, chetanas chetanam, eko yo vidadati kamam. One, nitya means eternal. So you see the same word here in the verse twice. Nitya and nityanam. And the difference between the two is that the one is singular and the next one is plural. And chaitanas, chaitanam means conscious, consciousness or cognizant. And again, you have chaitanas, which is singular, and then you have chaitanam, which is plural. So nitya, there is one supreme eternal who is God. And we are also eternal, but we're not supreme. He's infinite, and we're infinitesimal. He's like the sun, and we're like little particles of sunshine. So there's one supreme eternal, nitya. Nityanam, there are innumerable plural eternals, parts and parcels of the Lord. There's one supreme, chaitanas, cognizant, all cognizant living being, who's cognizant of everything. And then there are chaitanam, there are also little cognizant parts and parcels of God. We're not cognizant of everything, we're only cognizant of the pains and pleasures in our particular body. Eko yo vidadati kama. That one eternal, cognizant, living being supplies all the necessities of life to the many. Just like a father, he has as many children as he can afford to support, isn't it? As many children. If his income is of such a nature, then he'll have 3 kids. If he has income of such a nature, he has, like nowadays, it costs, I don't know, what, $1 million to send your kid, raise your child and go to graduate school? So people are only having 1 or 2 kids because they can't afford it, you know. Not too long ago when people lived on a farm and they were living on the land and they could grow all the food and all everything they needed right on the land, they'd have 5, 6, 8, 10, 12 kids. Because they could support it. The land could support it. Now we're not on the land and everything's based on currency rather than natural wealth. So people have dwindled now to having 1 or 2 children. But as any parent will have as only those number of children they can support, God supports all of His children, and because He's unlimitedly wealthy, every single one of them is provided for. And if He provides food for the animals, will He not supply for the human beings? If mom feeds the cats, will she not also feed the kids? If father takes care of the family car, will he not take care of the kids? If they take care of the lesser thing, will they not take care of the more important thing? If God provides for the animals, will He not provide for the human beings? And taking that one step further, if He provides for the human beings, will He not provide for those who are engaged in His devotional service? Prabhupada used to say, you do not have to pray for your daily bread. Our Father in heaven, hallowed be thy name, give us our daily bread. You do not have to pray for your daily bread. The elephant is not praying. He's getting 500 kgs a day. The ant is not praying. He's getting his. Every living being is getting his sustenance. You do not have to pray to God for daily bread. So Krishna is telling us in the Bhagavad Gita why we can face uncertainty. We can face uncertainty. He's not taking away uncertainty, but he's taking away worry at the same time. Prabhupada says here in a book called As They Surrender Unto Me, a devotee, an ideal character, he works but without attachment. Attachment is a synonym for worry. If you're attached, if your devotion is other than God, if it's temporary, then you're what we call attached. And like I said, we're not trying to get rid of attachments, but we're trying to shift our attachments. We're not trying to not be devoted, but we're trying to shift our devotion. So attachment should be transferred to the Lord. And then these are the symptoms of someone who works without attachment. In other words, they work, but without worry. He has no expectations for the result of the work entrusted to him, because he is above false ego and pride. Still, he is always enthusiastic till the completion of such work. He does not worry about the distress undertaken. He's always enthusiastic. He does not care for success or failure. He is equal in both distress and happiness. Such a worker is situated in the mode of goodness. So that, I think, will suffice for the introduction, part one. And then we'll conclude, I believe, based on the number of slides we've gone through today, that we will indeed conclude.